Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host today, Chris Kington Barker. Immigration reform has been a topic of heated discussion and is an issue with huge national implications. It also has an impact here on the Central Coast. Today I'm talking with immigration attorneys Kevin Gregg and Matthew Guerrero about the influence legal and illegal immigration has on our local economy, public services, and some of the more common perceptions and misconceptions of who our immigrants are. You can join today by calling in at 781-3875, and I'll start with Kevin Gregg, who is a private practice attorney in Paso Robles, primarily focusing on immigration law. He's a member of the State Bar of California, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and is on the board of the Paso Robles Youth Foundation. So welcome to you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
And then sitting on the other side here is Matt Guerrero, who is a public defender for SLO County, who also practices civil litigation selectively and is a board member of the Latino Outreach Council and an officer for the California Attorneys for Criminal Justice. And you've been practicing since 1999.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so both of you, this is an area that you're pretty familiar and comfortable with. So I'm delighted to have you both here today.
Thanks for having us.
I think that, you know, the first question for me is it seems to me in kind of reading what I can and staying up to date, that there were some major changes in our U.S. immigration law starting with September 11th, 2001, that came about. It seemed like there was a real shift from who was in charge of immigration law, and there was a lot that came down. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Actually, it started a little bit earlier than that. Actually, in 1996 is when the law was changed. IRA, it's the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Control Act of 1996. And what that did was increase the punishments for certain civil immigration violations and for certain criminal convictions. And it made it very, very difficult for immigrants who were already here to leave without basically putting them in a position where they would never be able to come back lawfully.
Okay.
Shortly after that, there was a, without getting too much into the legal mumbo-jumbo, there was a sunset of the law that was 245I that used to permit people who came illegally, which, it should be noted, used to be a lot easier back in the day. Living in San Diego, you'd hear stories of people who lived in Mexico, worked in the United States, and would walk across the border,
right,
on the border every day, go back at night. We didn't have the enforcement that we currently have. So back before 2001, people who came illegally and married, say, a U.S. citizen or had a citizen child or were otherwise eligible for a visa could file in the United States and just pay a fine of $1,000 and receive their green card. That went away after 2001. So we had a situation where there was increased penalties and punishment and enforcement, and an inability for people who are already here to do anything to normalize their status. Then after September 11th, 2001, they started enforcing a lot of those laws a lot more tightly and really ramped up border enforcement,
mm-hmm,
and interior enforcement as far as finding as many people here as possible, placing them in removal proceedings, which is the process for deporting them and getting them outside the United States. So September 11th really was the trigger that made those laws so powerful and what really changed the current immigration climate that we have.
So they were on the books. They just weren't being enforced as
stringently. They were enforced. Yes, I think that the focus on border enforcement and immigration just wasn't as the emphasis wasn't there as much until September 11, mm-hmm, 2001. And obviously that changed, not just immigration, but a lot of things. But one of the things that changed a lot and continued to change was immigration law. Enforcement continued to ramp up to and through this current administration. The number of deportations increased, the amount of spending going towards the border, towards building the fence, towards deporting people who are already here increased tenfold, and it was continuing to do so to this day.
Okay. Okay. And you've been practicing, Matt, here in this county. You've been doing immigration law for a number of years now.
No, actually, I do criminal law and some civil litigation.
Okay.
But there are the immigration consequences. There's some overlap with immigration, of course, and so we've had to become aware of the immigration and our responsibilities towards those particular clients.
Has that been increasing?
Absolutely. There's been some Supreme Court decisions that require us as criminal defense attorneys to talk to our clients about immigration consequences and to advise them that there may be immigration consequences. And there are times where I have to refer to somebody like Kevin and get more specific advice on how to get appropriate dispositions.
When we're talking about immigration reform, okay, what are we talking about with the reform? Can you kind of summarize that?
Well, we're talking about everything.
Okay.
What was released a couple of weeks ago in the Senate is an 850-page bill, and I've seen some summaries that run to over 100 pages. And I think that's one of the interesting things about this bill is that it really is comprehensive immigration reform, something people have been talking about for years but has never come close to happening. It definitely focuses on what I think the driving force and what we hear the most about is what to do with those that are here right now without documents.
Right.
But there are also significant changes to enforcement, to legal immigration, to future flow of skilled and unskilled labor, down to little minutia categories, Iraqi interpreters, people from certain countries in Central America, for example. There's some real minutia in there. And it really is comprehensive, but obviously the driving force and what most people are thinking about is that large population of undocumented people.
There is a supposition here on the Central Coast about who our immigrants are. Can you kind of give a definition of who are the immigrants that we're talking about? Are we only talking about Latinos?
Well, I don't think we are. Just yesterday in court, I had a Syrian national.
Mm-hmm.
We've had plenty – I shouldn't say plenty isn't the right word, but we've had a number of Armenians. Most of them are Latino. I think that's predominant, but they're from all over.
I would say in my practice it's actually close to 50-50 Latino and non-Latino. And usually people assume that the majority of my clients are Latinos
and
farm workers are driven by the agricultural community.
Right.
But I've had clients from – the Ukraine, New Zealand, South Africa, from every continent except Antarctica. And I don't think there are any immigrants from Antarctica. I'm not sure. But San Luis Obispo County, although it's small, is still a very desirable place to be.
Yes.
Especially with the growing agriculture, growing wine industry, and with maybe not as fast as we would like, but a growing tech industry in San Luis Obispo. There are a lot of immigrants who are both moving here to start companies, who have lived here for a while. So the truth is I would say it's about 50-50 in my practice. And I'm sure Matt
does that surprise people when you tell them that?
Yes, a whole lot. And it really shouldn't to some degree because I think walking around in downtown San Luis, for example, people will know people who maybe, somebody they know that works at a
from
a
Australia or New Zealand
and I think,
South Africa.
And I think maybe there might be the idea that people who speak English as a first language, even if they're from another country, aren't immigrants or that it's an easier path for them to get here and it might not strike them that way.
Is it?
No, generally not. So, under the law, at least, it's not easy. There might be some economic factors that make it more likely for immigrants from that country to move here. But under the law, it's not easier to get a visa than it would be from any other country.
So what are some of the challenges, say, for someone who's trying to come to this country to start a business?
To start a business, just lots and lots of red tape. And that's one area where the slow pace of legislation in Washington, I think, has had us behind other countries. There are some countries in South America, for example, that are basically saying, if you move here and start a business, we'll give you a visa. We'll even give you startup money.
The countries
will give you, I believe Chile is one of them, will say, here's $50,000 and a visa, start your company, especially given a downturn, you know, we need people to create companies, take risks, and start, you know, and create jobs. The U.S. hasn't changed their laws relating to entrepreneurs and people who wanted to start businesses in a good 15 years or so. There are basically two options, an E2, which is for investors who are from certain countries that we have treaties with. And even then, it's not clear how much money they have to invest. Just like everything else with the law, we create these arbitrary tests. They have to invest a substantial amount of money, which could be anywhere from $25,000 to $1 million, depending on what you're doing and what the company is.
Substantial to who?
Exactly. Right. And you have to make a pretty significant outflow of capital at the start to prove that you're serious. Rent office space, you know, hire employees if necessary. But you're doing that without any guarantee that you're actually going to get the visa.
Right.
So when you tell people their option is to spend $10,000 to get things moving without guarantee that they're going to get it, they'll say, fine, we'll go somewhere else where it's a little bit easier. And the only other major option is they call it the $1 million green card, the EB-5, which is for people who are going to invest $1 million or more. And for most entrepreneurs, most people who want to move here to start a company, they have high hopes, but they might not have $1 million backing. One of the ideas in the reform would be, first of all, giving permanent resident visas to people who graduate from the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, who are more likely to start companies. But it would also include a startup visa. And we'll see if that actually happens.
So that's written in the reform now?
The startup visa, actually, I don't believe is. Okay. It's a separate bill. The STEM category visas are in there, though, yes.
Okay. And how would somebody apply for legalization or a work permit? Is there a process that's laid out to them to do that if someone wanted to come here?
I'm going to monopolize all the time.
Oh. It's okay.
The short answer is no. The long answer is maybe, but there really is no visa just because somebody has been in the U.S. for a certain period of time, just because they have children, just because they're married to a citizen. There is no visa available that you can apply for with the government just because of that. If you're married to a citizen, you might have options available, but that depends on how you entered. If you entered legally with a visa, say, it's pretty easy to do. But if you entered illegally and have been here for 15 years, it's pretty difficult.
What if you were married in a foreign country?
Without family ties, for people who are already in the country, without some type of family ties, there's really no way to get a visa except for a few things that don't come up too often, like a U visa, which is for victims of crime. Who help in the investigation or prosecution of the perpetrator. Well, that's helpful for the people that's happened to, but it's not something that you can go and seek out or that you're going to get because of your ties or because you've been a good person or because you've worked and paid your taxes. So for those, even people who married in a different country, immigrated here, had children here, those children can't petition until they're 21 for the parents. And even then, if the parents entered illegally all those years ago, there's nothing that can be done to petition for them. The petition can be filed, but the parents can't apply for a visa, basically. So I think that's one of the misunderstandings about the current immigration law that goes back to the changes in the law I discussed at the beginning, that the community doesn't realize. It drives me crazy when I hear somebody say, well, they should have filed when they had the chance, or what's taken them so long. Everybody that comes into my office, if they had a chance, they would. And sometimes they're willing to take a chance even if it's a high risk and even if it's going to be expensive because they want that opportunity. The problem is the opportunity doesn't exist right now.
So if they went to some place in their country to say, okay, how do I go to the U.S., there really isn't a clear answer.
Without family in the United States or without being some type of a high-skilled, you know, a bachelor's degree or higher and a certain amount of experience, it's very, very difficult.
And that identifies the brain drain that happens from other countries. Like specifically, you'll see doctors being brought in from India and other people from other nationalities that are high skilled, computer tech, medical. scientific, you know, astronomers and that kind of thing, where they will be brought in, but it's an intellectual brain drain. And so part of the problem here is with those who are uneducated. If you look at Latin America, where a sixth grade education is considered the compulsory education for those that can get it, many of my clients cannot read or write. And so when you say to them, you should have followed the procedure, their question is, what procedure was I supposed to follow and how was I supposed to find out about it?
Right.
And so they come to the States. They're low-skilled workers. They're some of them, of course, talking about the immigrant field worker type laborer.
Right.
And when you try to offer them advice or you seek out counsel for them to try to clear the paths, you find that the roadblocks are higher than – or the hurdles are higher than you can get over generally.
So there really is no path, legal path for them?
I think it's part of the problem with the legislation. One of the government's job is to provide clear and concise governance and direction for people to set discernible boundaries. And like what Kevin was explaining earlier, it's impossible to figure out, and especially for those who are uneducated or don't have resources to seek out somebody like Kevin's services. So,
was it ever easier to figure out?
Yes, in two ways. One, because the consequences of trying and failing weren't as high, meaning now if you were to file for something and weren't eligible and were denied, you would get deported, and that's can have serious long-term consequences to your ability to be here. So I think a lot more people have seen friends and family members face those consequences,
right,
and they're less likely to file for something that might be available again. But yes, it was easier then because there isn't anything available now. Like there used to be, obviously, we had the amnesty in 86 and the agricultural amnesty in 88. But before then, before 2001, somebody who entered illegally would be able to marry a citizen, marry a resident, have children who were born here, who could petition for them. And it wasn't necessarily the fastest process, but it was easier. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. The other thing was that if somebody was caught for immigration violation, something like that, there was a waiver, kind of a pardon they could ask for that was a lot more accessible. You basically had to prove that you'd been here for 7 years and were a good person.
You hadn't been arrested or...
Right.
Uh-huh.
And now, if you are caught, you can still file for a waiver similar with an immigration judge, but it requires that you've been here 10 years, that you haven't been convicted of a subset of crimes, and that you prove exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to your U.S. citizen children, spouse, or parents. And everybody, and I would argue everybody does suffer exceptional and extremely unusual hardship, but it's a legal term, and it's basically been limited to people who have conditions that, you know, family situations nobody would want. Severe physical or medical or educational problems. And because of that, people who raise happy, healthy families, if they do get placed in immigration court, have a very difficult time winning.
Wow.
Kind of a backwards approach. But
yeah. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Radio. I am Chris Kington Barker, and we're talking about immigration law and reform. My guests today are Matt Guerrero, a public defender for Slo County, and Kevin Gregg, an attorney in private practice focusing on immigration law. Both Matt and Kevin are also members of the Latino Outreach Council. If you have questions or comments about today's topic, please call us at 781-3875. We'd love to hear from you. For deportations and some of the strict laws, are those areas that you get involved in
regularly? It's a common question to ask somebody. We have to ask almost every client if they are an American citizen, and if you have suspicion that they're not an American citizen, you need to advise them that this may have deportation consequences, that they may be denied amnesty or naturalization based upon even some certain low-level misdemeanors or multiple misdemeanors. And so you talk to them, and what you often find out is what Kevin was identifying, is that they have families here, they've been here for a number of years, and that their children live here and are American citizens. It's very common for me to have clients who are deported And I have to advise them that if they're deported, that this is a federal proceeding, their return without proper documentation, which again is difficult to get or maybe impossible because now their status as being convicted, is a federal offense. And so they return, they go back to their same houses, they get brought into court, and they might think they're getting a 10-day probation violation, but in fact they're going to get released to the federal courts and are looking at 2 years or more in federal custody just for the act of returning. And so this is
By coming back to the country.
By coming back to the country. And this is a discussion that we have regularly with people who are foreign nationals. And depending upon the person, depends on whether or not it sinks in or how desperate they are or their priority. Do you take care of your family or do I risk going to federal penitentiary?
Right.
Or do I stay in Mexico where I can't support myself or my family?
And does that happen very frequently, that there is a return and there is a rearrest with federal time?
Yes, very frequently.
Very frequently.
And it's very unfortunate, and I cannot stress it enough to the particular clients. And, you know, I think at first, when it started happening a few years ago that it became more common, the clients didn't believe me. They believe me now.
They do believe you.
For the most part, yeah.
And so while we're going through, let's say here in California, there's all of this discussion about overcrowding in jails and how we're trying to offload from state to county to, you know, what we're doing now is for people that are coming back into the area after they've been deported, now we're furthering.
It does lead to more crowding in the jails. They are held in the jails until immigration will come and pick them up and take them to the federal holding facilities.
And where the federal facilities are here in California as well? Or
no, not always, no. Kevin.
One of the reasons enforcement picked up, if I can go about a minute or two, one of the reasons that enforcement picked up recently is because the federal government introduced something called Secure Communities, which is basically using technology to find out when somebody is in detention and is able to be deported. So it used to be, even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, somebody would be arrested, put in jail, and then released, you know, a week or so later. But now, as soon as they're booked, their fingerprints get sent to the FBI, who then sends their information to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So ICE pretty much always knows now if somebody is in the U.S. illegally, if they're detained in a facility. And that's why it used to be people would come back or they would be put in jail and wouldn't get caught. Now it's pretty much a certainty. About 100% of the time they get picked up. So ICE comes 2 times a week to the local jail in San Luis Obispo, more often in Santa Barbara. And they take them to the downtown facility in L.A., downtown Los Angeles, and then they get basically shipped out to wherever there's an immigration bed available at one of the immigration detention facilities, which is a civil detention facility usually contracted with a big private prison company, CCA or GEO. So they'll get shipped sometimes as far as Texas, Washington, or Louisiana, where some of the bigger facilities
are. And
they're
held for years there?
Years only in very extreme cases, but they're threatened that it's going to be years frequently. But it can be weeks before they even get a bond hearing where an immigration judge will decide if they can leave on a bond. And if they don't get a bond or the bond is too high to pay, then yes, it's likely to be months to 6 months or more. Obviously, many people, when faced with that opportunity, decide to sign and accept a voluntary departure or to leave instead of actually seeing a judge and fighting their case.
Wow. We have a call. Richard, are you there?
Hello.
Hi. You had a question or a comment? You're on air.
Okay. Well, hold on. Let me get the other phone.
Okay. Richard?
Yes.
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. You had a question or a comment?
Well, I have a question, yeah.
All right.
And a comment.
Okay. We're ready for both.
Okay, I've lived here for 52 years in Santa Maria. I'm a fluent Spanish speaker. I'm married to an Hispanic, and I remember Cesar Chavez was very strongly opposed to illegal immigration because it lowered the wages of field workers, and they had an awful hard time getting him on board for the 1986 amnesty. So my questions are this. there is an H-2A program that they're going to try to modify it so the farmers can use it. I would like to know why so many Hispanic organizations are not in favor of bringing them here on temporary work permits to harvest our crops and take the money back to their own countries to better their lives in their own countries. Why do they want them to come here permanently and let people from Croatia, like I've got relatives in Croatia, they've been waiting for years to come here legally. Okay, and then the other comment is it right that $16 an hour black janitors be laid off at Century City to make room for illegal aliens that are working for minimum wage? That was widely publicized.
Okay, good. Good questions. So I'm going to go with Matt first.
No, I don't think it's right that American citizens be laid off for cheaper wages. And as far as illegal immigration, I don't think what we're proposing or the Latino Outreach would be proposing is that anybody do anything illegal. I think what we're proposing is that the path and the ability to immigrate, even if it's just a work permit, be easier and more accessible. And it's not only for the individual who's coming here to work, but it's also for the employers, the agricultural community who rely on this labor force, which I believe the undocumented force is over 50%. I've heard numbers as high as 70% of the workers being undocumented. And so it helps agriculture, it helps employers, it helps all of these peoples and the individuals to comply with the laws, and that's part of what we were talking about with the laws being clear and adding more certainty so that there is a path that can be followed.
And so what is the H-2A visa?
The H-2A is a temporary seasonal agricultural visa. Unfortunately, it's a temporary seasonal agricultural visa that gets used very, very rarely now. And part of the primary reason for that is because as a government program, it's gotten caught up in so much bureaucracy and red tape that no agricultural employers want to use it. Basically, what they have to do is say in advance, we know we're going to need this many agricultural employees. They have to try to find them. Mm-hmm. Locally within the United States. If they can't, they have to file a petition with the government and say, we need this many workers. Will you approve it? Then they have to contract with a labor company in a foreign country to find those workers who can then apply for the visas and then come. So when you factor in all the fees to the government, the time and the hassle, it has become so expensive for agricultural employers in the past 5 years or so that there are very, very few in California that still use it.
Okay.
A good number in the Central Valley. I believe there's a handful in Salinas and maybe one in Gonzales. But I know a handful of about 3 years ago there were zero in all of San Diego because they said, this is too much. We just can't do it anymore. So the H-2A does exist, but it's extremely flawed and isn't used. I think that's when Cesar Chavez was talking about this, the laws were very different, and it was possible to get temporary workers here, which is why he would have been opposed, I would imagine. I haven't spoken with him, but he would have been opposed to having illegal immigrants lower the wages.
Yeah.
But it's so, you know, things have changed so much now in the 25-plus years that now we have pretty much, numbers 50% or who knows, undocumented agricultural workers, but we're still hearing within the county and elsewhere that there's a shortage of laborers. Mm-hmm. So, it's not that there's too many, clearly, it's that we need a way to find more seasonal workers to come in legally. There are, that is addressed in the new reform bill.
How is it addressed?
There's a proposed W visa, a W visa, which would be a temporary seasonal visa, whereby workers could come in, work seasonally, not just in agriculture, but also in other seasonal jobs such as hospitality, and then would be able to return. There's also a agricultural streamlined path to citizenship offered for those who have been here in the past working in agriculture. But as far as future flow, there's that the W visa. Part of the problem with it, and that was one of the reasons that it took so long for them to release the bill, they kept saying we'll have it released next week, and that happened for about 3 or 4 weeks. Part of the problem was that you had all the different groups that are interested, agricultural workers, Chamber of Commerce, private employers, wanting to get their piece of it. You know, we want to have guarantees that our workers are going to be protected. Chamber of Commerce saying we want to have guarantees that prices are going to be at least, you know, wages are going to be at least this much. So now instead of being a short thing, even the proposal is already pretty complicated about what the employers are going to have to do. And we might end up in a situation where it's just like the H-2A and isn't used at all.
It's so cumbersome that people won't want to use it.
Exactly.
Okay.
So.
Okay. It doesn't sound like it's getting any easier.
I mean,
Kevin.
there's a reason that I have a job. You know, I have said, and I have told clients, I would love if there was a time when I would have to find another area of law to practice.
I don't think you're going to run out of material for quite a while.
At this point, you know, I've had friends of mine who are very educated, who sometimes have advanced degrees or are doctors, and can't figure out how to do it on their own and need to bring an attorney just to file for a spouse. Or to, you know, file for their employment. And it shouldn't be something that somebody with a high school degree should have an impossible time doing.
No.
But that's where it is. And, you know, that's why I am able to do what I do and enjoy doing it. But I would love if people
It'd
were able to do it on
simpler.
Their own a little bit more.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, serving San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties and southern Monterey County. I'm Chris Kington Barker. We're talking about immigration and immigration reform. My guests are Kevin Gregg, an attorney specializing in immigration law and a member of the Latino Outreach Council, and Matt Guerrero, a public defender for Salo County, who practices selective civil litigation and also is a member for the Latino Outreach Council. Do you have an immigration question, concern, or comment? You can still join our conversation by calling 781-3875. And I'm going to go to Sandra here. Sandra, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, did you have a question?
Well, I do. And actually, one thing that I'm so thankful that you guys are having this program. This is a great conversation. One thing that I would like you guys to discuss is that about all the notarios, and I know the attorneys are exactly, you know what I'm talking about. All these people who are public notaries who really take advantage of the community, they act like they're attorneys, and they're really not. And they're taking advantage of the community, taking their money, and telling them, oh, yes, you are going to get a green card. I can assure you're going to get a green card. My friend ended up going with one of these notarios in Santa Maria, and they filed the paperwork, and her husband had been here for 15 years. They have 3 children. She's a U.S. citizen. The children are U.S. citizens. He got there to Mexico, and they gave him a penalty of 10 years for being here illegally. So the other option he had was to come back illegally, got caught 3 times, but thankfully, now he's back here with his family. But he said, I'm not going to be away from my family for 10 years. So, but these people, they advertise on the radio and the Hispanic radio, and it's just really a big problem.
Thank you for that, Susan. And I'm going to have Matt explain.
I'm Sandra.
Sandra, I'm going to have Matt explain a little bit more about what you're talking about, but thank
sure.
you.
Yeah. Thank you, Sandra. That actually is something that happens in the Latino community. In Latin America, the idea of a notary is much more significant than what we have here. And there is this perception of these notarios or these notaries that prey on the community. And they basically, I mean, I think from Kevin and my perspective, oftentimes practice law without a license. Kevin's nodding good. And so you end up with paperwork that's not filled out or bad advice being given to people, and they charge significant funds or significant amounts. And it becomes problematic when you have somebody like the situation that Sandra talked about, that somebody who ends up getting deported or their family law cases or their civil cases or their wills or something that happens. And the Hispanic community these people are often, colloquially we hear stories about they want to complain, and the notario says, well, if you complain, I'm going to turn you in. And so they end up not having a voice, and they were trying to do something good for them or their families, and they end up not having a voice because they're afraid to go to the authorities. And so it's not the first time I've heard these situations and stories, and unfortunately, immigrant low-income people are more suspect or more likely to be victimized by this.
That's unfortunate, yeah.
It's very tragic, actually, and this is, again, not an untypical story. I don't know Sandra, but I've heard this story before.
Is there something that's happening within the community to try and warn people? Do you, through legal aid or something, are you able to reach out to the community to provide some legal assistance?
Well, so, I mean, if Sandra wants to give me a call, I can have a good four-hour conversation about all this. You start seeing the same things come through, and it is heartbreaking.
This is not isolated.
This is not an isolated incident.
And
it's actually
if the advertising's on radio, I would think that it's
bold.
Certainly not.
It's actually a lot, fortunately, a lot rarer up here than it is in other areas. Los Angeles, San Diego, it's rampant. Santa Maria and Salinas have a lot of notarios, and essentially they are practicing law without a license.
Mm-hmm. And it's also just not the Latinos. It happens in the Asian community
extensively. And there's definitely something about an insular community that makes it, that perpetuates itself with it. But especially with immigration law, where the consequences can be so harsh, it's really frustrating to see. So what just to give a quick example, what we usually see is it's not as common anymore, but it used to be that you could get a work permit immediately after filing an asylum application. So people would go in and visit somebody who would say, no problem, I can get you a work permit. And they either wouldn't tell them what they were filing, or they would say, because you're from Mexico, you're eligible for asylum, which on its face, if that was the case, everybody would be applying from Mexico, you would think. But so they apply and they get a work permit a couple of months later and think, great, everything's going according to plan. But then they get referred to an interview where they don't know what's on their application, and it's the first time they realize that they've applied for asylum, and they get referred to court and eventually deported.
And what does it mean to apply for asylum?
That you have a fear of returning to your home country for a specific reason.
Okay.
Meaning you're going to be prosecuted on race, religion, political opinion, membership in a social group, which although people have fear of returning to Mexico, it usually isn't for a specific reason. It's just because of the violence.
Right.
So they get referred to court and eventually deported. What Sandra was talking about actually sounded like something a little bit different, but it's along the same lines where they're not honest. They don't tell them exactly what the requirements are and what the consequences and risks are. And yes, I mean, once you're out of the country, it's very hard to file an ethics complaint or to file a lawsuit against somebody. And yes, they do use tactics of fear, threatening to call immigration authorities, report them. And the chances of that happening are very unlikely, but obviously the person doesn't realize that. So within the community, the good news is there is more of an awareness, especially with the reform. There are a lot more groups becoming interested in immigration law. In Santa Maria this Sunday is a citizenship fair being put on by CAUSE with a lot of involvement by the local community. And I've just had a lot more, people get in touch with me because they're interested.
Is that going to be held?
It is in Santa Maria. I don't have the exact address.
Okay, and CAUSE is CAUSE?
If you go to CAUSE now, NOW.org.
Okay.
That's a local immigrant advocacy organization, and they'll have information on their website.
Okay.
So it's really just putting on little things like that. When deferred action for childhood arrivals, the DREAM Act deferred action was announced last year, I tried to go and have as many presentations as possible, and I know there were a bunch of other people doing it. And that's really, what you need, community involvement, so that there are other people to go to and ask questions if maybe you're not sure about the person that you talked to at first,
right,
or maybe you didn't quite feel comfortable.
We talk about, you had mentioned the Asian community too, and I have read that is a population that is really increasing in terms of immigration here in California. We talk about Latino population, and certainly is a large immigration population, but Asian community as well is expanding dramatically. And, I think, are there myths around immigration, Matt, that kind of are more common than others?
Well, I think we touched on some of them earlier when you talk about myths surrounding immigration. Well, why didn't you file earlier? Or why didn't you fill out the paperwork? Or why didn't you go see somebody? And, you know, like Kevin pointed out, you're really stuck. It's kind of the legal pickle here in some places because, well, you couldn't, and now you can't. And
yeah.
So what were you supposed to do? And it's real easy to say, well, you should do something or you should have filled something out. But the legislation's not clear. The policies, the procedures, they're not clear. And so I think those are the myths, I think, that people expect, is that they think that it's easier than it is.
Right. We had somebody call in who said that they're a legal Costa Rican immigrant and want to know why so many uneducated illegal and legal immigrants are having so many children which they can't support. Program called AFDC goes unfairly to them.
Not familiar with AFDC.
I think that's welfare.
I would like to address it. It's a good question, and I understand why it's something that frustrates people. But I'd kind of like to turn it around a little bit, and I don't know if it's the reason or not, because obviously everybody has different reasons for starting families and having children, and some of them, you know, people might agree with and some not. But I think one of the reasons is because there are no other resources available. When you're marginalizing a community, if somebody is here undocumented and, you know, there are two approaches that both sides want, you know, one side wants to take. You had heard self-deportation a lot last year. Let's make things so difficult on people that they have no choice but to leave.
Yes.
And then you have what happens more often in California, which is let's give them some type of benefits and try to make them a part of the community. You had the California Dream Act and AB 540 in the past, which gives undocumented students who graduated from high school here access to financial aid and in-state tuition. So those are the two approaches. Either we make things really bad or we try to do what we can within the bounds of federal law. But when you are marginalizing somebody, whether, you know, for whatever reason, and you don't give them the opportunity to work, you don't give them access to health care or to education or to family planning or to really any type of benefits, you don't leave them with a whole lot of options. And I'm not saying that's what leads people to have children, but it's certainly a factor into why there is, why there is a whole lot of, I don't know what the right word is, but why there isn't family planning, why people are making decisions that are based on their current situation and what's economically and feasible for them. So there's no good answer to her question,
and we appreciate it.
It's also easy to spot somebody who has a lot of children that we think from the outside that they can't support. It's very easy to spot that person, and like the immigrant community or somebody that's not what we would think of as the norm, if they dress differently, if they're easy to spot, they got religious differences, that makes them an easy target. And so 1% or some small percentage can really skew your perspective on the whole population.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would have to kind of weigh in on this too. Having administered rural health centers for a number of years, I would say that very frequently what we would see is large families and people walking with oodles of kids that weren't necessarily all their children either.
Right.
So I think it can be a brushstroke that is really broad that may or may not apply to reality there. So
I think that we get caught up in our misperceptions and see things to validate them. But just to give a quick anecdotal example, you know, I've had lots of clients with the deferred action for childhood arrivals. So children who came from a foreign country when they were very young went to high school here.
Yes.
So if you find out, you're going to high school and you find out, like most of these kids did when they're 15, 16, or 17, that you don't have documents. So you have plans. You go through all the same education everybody else does where it says you can be anything you want. You can be a doctor.
Right.
Or an attorney, heaven forbid. and then you find out when you're 16 or 17 that you don't have documents, and you look into what that means, and it means you don't have a Social Security number. You can't get a driver's license. You can't get any type of professional license. If you want to be a nurse, you can't join the military, which a lot of people, my clients wanted to do.
Correct.
And all of a sudden, what are your options? You've never been to your home country. And
you may not speak that language.
You might not speak the language, and you can't work here. So that doesn't leave you with a lot of options. People either get married and start a family, or they find some type of work under the table that isn't fit for their educational or intelligence level.
Right.
So it's been very empowering to see with the deferred action, how many people have said, even if they've been out of high school for 8 years or longer, have said great and have gone back to school and are pursuing a nursing license or something. So, you know, when you don't have a lot of hope, you know, what options are available to you? What are you going to do? And again, I don't want to say that that's the driving force by it, but I think it's important in all of this that we look at what being an undocumented status means to somebody and to this country and how it affects our local community.
And especially what we would call the Dream Act kids, those who came here later. I know a young lady exactly in the situation that Kevin talked about who graduated from high school, speaks English, is culturally American, and yet finds out, you know, that she's not and is in nursing school, but she may never be licensed. She's never lived in Mexico
so
or South America.
She can go through school. She right. can she, finish.
She's making
she
it through.
She can't get
right.
her license.
Yeah.
And probably paying for it out of pocket because she
can't get
she
financial
qualify.
Aid
under
to the
yeah.
federal. Right.
This is Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 89.5 Santa Barbara, 91.7 Paso Robles to Salinas, 90.9 Santa Ynez, Avila Beach, Cambria, 91.1 Cayugas, 95.1 Lompoc, and KCBX also streams worldwide through the web. A reminder that This American Life will follow at 2 p.m. today. My guests are Matt Guerrero and Kevin Gregg, both practicing attorneys in San Luis Obispo County with interest and expertise in immigration law and also working with immigration issues here in this county. We have about 15 minutes left in this program. You still have time to hear from you. You can reach us at 781-3875. When we're talking, you know, when you're talking about some of the immigration challenges and you were just talking about that story, I have a step-granddaughter who actually is faced with that very challenge. She came here as a 9-year-old, brought here by her parents who subsequently divorced. Mother stayed here. Father went back to home country. And she went through high school, went through all of that, and she is illegal status. Mother never got her citizenship. She's now 21 years old, and she's not able to work. She's got no work permit, no work visa. She's struggling right now because she's trying to get married, and she's pregnant, and she's, you know, she's trying to assimilate herself and stay in this country, and she's from Italy. She's not, you know, she is not from right. from a Latin American country. I've got two friends who are Canadians who were here, who were brought here as kids, neither one of which are American citizens, and at any point could be deported, you know, and have lived in this country since they were small children. One of them is, in fact, a licensed nurse who's been hiding that status because her visa ran out. You know, so I mean, it's not an uncommon issue, and for them, it's kind of this under the, you know, it's not really talked about, and those are things that come out and are just little critical pieces of we don't think about it in terms of every day. So it's much broader, I think, when we're talking about immigration. You know, my family immigrated here.
Yes, did mine.
And, you know, I was going to ask, too, my dad actually married my mother in Germany, and then she's a German immigrant right. who moved here after the war. So for her, she was married there, was able to immigrate here, and became a nationalized citizen. So those things can still happen. They're more restrictive.
Those things can still happen, and in the abstract are fairly easy to do, but in practice are complicated because
yes.
of requirements and because of delays in processing and because of costs. So it still can happen, but it usually takes a good 6 months to a year and a good amount of money.
Being, you know, having worked in the field of healthcare too, it was very difficult in many situations to recruit professionals. You mentioned mm-hmm. physicians, and you know, I worked frequently with H-1B visas, mm-hmm. with physicians that would come over, or J-1 visas on physicians, or other health professionals. But those were restricted. You know, they're very restricted. And there are some limitations to those as well. Can you talk about the, you know, the recruitment of people through specific visas and what the impact is of that?
Well, what you'll see, and we should ask Kenna Burke about it if she's on the show of CHC, but a lot of their, I'm guessing, lot of their physicians are here on visas. And one of the reasons is because in underserved areas, which is obviously certain, I believe the whole county, but definitely certain parts of the county are considered,
right.
You can streamline your process to a green card, essentially, by serving some of those underserved areas. So that's, you know, there's so many intricacies that it makes it very difficult, but people find ways to do it because they want so badly to be able to live in the U.S. permanently, to get an immigrant visa. So a lot of those recruitment visas, an H-1B, a J-1, are non-immigrant visas, meaning they're not permanent. They're for somebody to reside and work in the U.S. temporarily. And even when there's a shortage of workers, the law isn't built in a way to react to that quickly. So I'm assuming you had to recruit nurses.
Right, we had to recruit nurses.
Nurses are still considered an under...
in some areas.
Some areas, but even within the country, they're exempt from certain requirements because it's assumed that we need those workers. Mm-hmm. Essentially, if you're going to hire somebody for a permanent position, you have to prove that you tried to search for other employees locally that are authorized to work.
Correct.
And couldn't find them. With nurses, it's assumed that you're not going to find enough qualified local people to take that position. But what happens then is that the health agency or doctor's office or whomever, or school or teaching facility, is on the hook for the expenses of recruiting somebody, paying for the attorney's fees.
Yes.
And that makes it prohibitively expensive in some cases. I see that a lot actually with local schools as well. There are a lot of schools. I had a speech-language therapist locally who require jobs like that, not necessarily teachers, but language therapists, school counselors. Mm-hmm. A lot of those are here on student visas, on temporary work, on-site training basically for their student visa. And once that expires, the schools don't want to petition them because it costs too much money. They probably don't meet the minimum wage requirements, but there's nothing else for them to stay here on. So the student wants to stay, the school wants them to stay, but it doesn't work out, and then the school doesn't have their full staff of support staff.
Right.
So it's just a big mess, is basically what it comes down to.
Well, in some cases, those individuals stay in the country.
They stay past their visa.
Their visa and become an illegal immigrant.
Right. And that's when people don't realize, because they're not from a country or something that fits into their mold, that they are technically an illegal immigrant.
Right.
But one of the things that's introduced in the reform is an in and out. Well, it was actually put in place a long time ago, but never actually implemented effectively. But is a computer in and out monitoring system, so that the government would know if somebody hadn't left at the time of their visa. So that's something that you know, it's one of the trade offs that's in this bill. Both sides want different things, and so far, I think both sides have them. Both sides have put in there what they want, and we'll see what comes out of it. But
so part of the reform is to make it more restrictive, more tracking for individuals?
Clear, defined lines.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Stricter enforcement outside the country, as far as getting in. Stricter enforcement once you're in the country. Interior enforcement, they call it, and the tracking for people who have overstayed. One of the things that's in there is a much more stringent employee verification requirement, where all employers would be required to verify every single employee. Right now, everybody just fills out the I-9.
Correct.
A lot of companies don't fill them out properly or fill them out at all, and those that do just have to make a reasonable inquiry into whether the documents are valid.
Well,
and frequently
pretty much
not.
Right now, you're having the employee fill it out and just verify that it's correct, and you're holding it in a file, correct?
They
What's
going to
change about
perjury.
That? Right.
What's going to is E-Verify is an electronic verification system, and there's a lot of complaints about it as far as accuracy and affecting people who are actually eligible to work but have a mishit because they changed their name or there's a hyphen in their name or something. But this would expand something similar to E-Verify to every single employer in the country, rolled out over about a five-year period. But basically, if you were going to hire somebody, you would have to run their information through a national system, check that they are who they say they are, and that they're eligible to work. So maybe they have a work permit, but it's expired, or they've fallen out of status. They're not eligible for it anymore. You'd never know just by looking at it, but if you do the check, it bounces back that they're not eligible to work. So that's one of the things that's included that is, you know, and the goal is to overcome the problems that we had after the 1986 reform,
right,
where the enforcement and employment eligibility parts of it never really went into place.
Now, what do you hope to have change? I mean, out of this reform, is there something that really sticks out that if one of the things that you were dealing with most frequently was going to shift, what would that be?
Well, I'd like to see the change be a compassionate reform. And that is to make it available so that people who are in a foreign country can access the information. They can access the applications for work visas or citizenship or residency, whatever it is that they want to do, and move forward with that. I would also like to see, especially the DREAM Act kids. I think those are people that we all have a heart for. These are young people who didn't make these decisions.
No.
They didn't make these decisions to come to this country without documentations and to be an illegal immigrant, but yet are being affected by it, even though they're culturally American. And what we're not suggesting, and I'll say this because I'm a public defender and I work with these people who have been convicted of crimes, I'm not suggesting that we be any more lenient on criminals. That convicted felons are exactly the kind of people that we want to deport, okay, that
yes.
there still will
yes.
be deportations.
Right.
But for those who are the good people that are raising their families, that are working, that are contributing, that are paying taxes, that are buying goods and services at our local vendors, that for them that they be able to get a path to citizenship, because we have this idea of a residency, and I think we still have this idea in our culture that all men are created equal. And to me, that is regardless of national origin, it's regardless of race, it's regardless of gender and all those other protected classes. And so I would like to see the pathway be accessible.
And really follow through on that,
yes.
that there is equality.
Right.
Okay. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and I want to thank my guests today, Matt Guerrero and Kevin Gregg. Next week on Voices, Fred Monroe will host speaking with Andrea Wasco and Megan Gilbert, who will talk about financial training seminars called Economics of Being a Woman. They'll be talking about information tools, resources they provide to help all women be financially educated and able to manage their money at every stage of life. You're invited to listen Thursday between 1 to 2 p.m. Voices. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX. This show addresses the many ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. Suggestions for future topics or questions about today's discussions can be sent to us at voices@kcbx.org. Thank you for listening and joining us today. Stay tuned for This American Life, and thank you very much, Matt and Greg, for joining me today.
Thank you for having us, Chris.